Hello, everybody. I'm Dave Custy. Welcome to the Local Issues Forum. Today, my guest is Sarah Heminger. Sarah Heminger co-founded Thread with her husband, Ryan Heminger, in 2004. She has more than 10 years of experience in nonprofit management and expertise in the development, expansion, and replication of innovative, paradigm-shifting models of mentoring. Sarah has a deep understanding of the challenges that face students in successfully completing high school and accessing higher education, as well as the potential for students and volunteers to change not only their own lives, but also create a positive and lasting impact on those around them. Sarah was awarded fellowships from the Albert Schweitzer Fellows Program, Open Society Institute, Echoing Green Foundation, and Ashoka. In 2010, Sarah received her PhD in biomedical engineering from the Johns Hopkins University for her work on the role of the cerebellum and the primary motor cortex on the timescales of consolidation of motor memory. She received the prestigious Seibel Scholars Award for outstanding work in the field of technology and engineering. Her research was published in the Journal of Neuroscience, Journal of Neurophysiology, and Cerebral Cortex, and she has lectured internationally on her work. She received her undergraduate degree from the Johns Hopkins University in 2002, and prior to pursuing her PhD, she worked as an engineer for Medtronic Zomed. Sarah enjoys ice skating and teaching aerobics. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words there, Sarah.
Well, I am a figure skater turned scientist turned social entrepreneur.
As you do.
And my parents joke that my name is prophetic and that it means mother of many. And I feel like that is really what my life has become, being the mother of many.
Well, tell us about your history, about growing up and how you got interested in what you're doing now.
So Thread started almost 11 years ago now, but the idea for Thread actually started almost 20 years ago when I was a freshman in high school. I showed up for my first day of school, and there was a guy sitting in the teacher's seat. We got in an argument about whether or not he was allowed to be sitting there. Anyway, long story short, we became friends. And as we became friends, at the time, I was a freshman. He was a senior. He was straight-A student, varsity athlete, getting ready to go to the Naval Academy. And I'd hear lots of rumors. You know, people would say his mom's a drug addict, his dad's in jail. And where I grew up in Indiana, that wasn't your traditional high school gossip. Mm. But you don't exactly want to walk up to a guy you have a crush on and say, so, you know, what's going on at home? But eventually he explained that years earlier, his mom had been in a really bad car accident and was temporarily paralyzed, couldn't walk, couldn't work, lost her job. They ended up losing their home. They moved from suburban Indianapolis into public housing. She became very depressed and addicted to the painkiller she'd been prescribed Dilaudid. That then spiraled out of control, where she then began selling to maintain her own habit. And, you know, he essentially went from the equivalent of cornfields to living in a drug house in a matter of about 9 months. And as a result, he ended up failing his classes his freshman year of high school, missing more than 30 days of school. He just really struggled with that transition from junior high to high school in the environment he was in. And so he's explaining this to me, and I'm trying to understand how in the world do you go from failing all of your classes to the Naval Academy. And he explained there were kind of two things. One, he just had to make tough decisions. So even if he hadn't eaten or showered or slept, he had to decide to go to school. But the second and really critically important part of it was that there was a group of teachers who really rallied around him, who made making those decisions a lot easier. So they would show up, give him a ride to school, bring him food, give him a place to do his laundry, tutor him after school. They basically said, this is like a human being whose basic needs aren't being met. What can we do to basically form an extended family around him when his family was in crisis? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, fundamentally changed his life. So Thread is really, there's kind of two components to the history of Thread. That's component one, and kind of how we figured out what would be done. But what actually caused Thread to come to fruition was, at the time when I saw him and got to know him, I thought, wow, like, I didn't really understand what the teachers has done, but I thought that he was like the most amazing person. And so we ended up dating and falling in love, and we've now been married for over 15 years. And so he came out to the Naval Academy, and we continued dating, and I stayed and obviously finished high school. And then I came out to Hopkins simply, I mean, the way I selected my college was that it was close to the Naval Academy. That was like my prerequisite for college selection. And during my undergrad time, I kind of focused solely on, I kind of had a master checklist of all the things that I wanted to do. I wanted to join a sorority and get a particular degree and get a particular internship. And there was this handbag that I wanted and the house I wanted and the guy I wanted to marry. And anyway, I ended up spending my entire undergraduate time kind of checking things off the list and found myself back in graduate school having checked everything off my list and just feeling completely unhappy. And I couldn't quite put my finger on why I was unhappy. It was around that time I was actually just driving right up the street from here down Orleans. And I noticed that Dunbar was on the left-hand side of the street and there was public housing on the right. And I'd driven the same way every single day, but it was just like in one moment, like someone had removed the blinders and I had noticed my environment. Yeah. And what was kind of the game-changing part of it, though, was when I then looked in front of me and saw the Hopkins buildings, a lot of times people think, you know, maybe, you know, the thing you might think standing on that corner at Caroline and Orleans is that, oh, the disparity between the two worlds. That wasn't what crossed my mind at all. What crossed my mind and really changed my life was that I thought, oh, I'll bet there's kids in the high school that are just like my husband, that are really intelligent and motivated, but are distracted by really challenging things outside of school. And the thing is, I thought, oh, I could more easily form friendships and relationships with these kids than I felt confident in my ability to do with my own peer group in graduate school. And so kind of the aha moment was really around why I was miserable at the time was I really had no family, no community. Like, I just was very alone. I felt very isolated. And I had not acclimated well to graduate school. And so when we talk about in Thread poverty, we talk about poverty as being alone. And that's something that everyone has experienced and everyone can relate to. And all of us, you know, have different burdens that we carry throughout life, but all of us need someone to support us and kind of help us carry that bundle. So that's how we actually got started. And what we do, though, is we enroll students that during their freshman year of high school are academically the most underperforming in their high school and are also facing challenges outside of school, similar to my husband. And then once they're enrolled, though, the approach is really that I'm not here to help you. We are here to come together, to grow together, to enrich both of our lives. And we used to say, you know, like everyone is a mentor, everyone is a mentee. It's not
mutually exclusive.
It's a very deep and meaningful mutual relationship. So once students are enrolled, then those relationships are facilitated with a group of up to 8 volunteers for one kid. So those 8 volunteers do everything from packed lunches, rides to school, tutoring, SAT, anything you would imagine doing for like your niece or nephew or your own child. That's essentially what we do with our kids. And they stay in the program for 10 years. So it's the rest of high school and 6 years after high school. Really critical to the nature of our program is that once kids are enrolled, they cannot get out. So if what we're doing is building extended families for all of us, you can't give your family back. Like once it's family, it's family. So if a kid doesn't show up, that doesn't mean they're out of the program. It just means that we persist even more. And that's been really key to kind of the evolution of things in this little community that we've built over the last, you know, almost 11 years now.
So you had the germ of an idea for Thread back in high school. How did biomedical technology get involved in your life?
Well, it's all actually part of the same story. So I had never planned on going to college. My parents aren't particularly, they never really pushed us, and my siblings or I, in the area of education, but they did push us to work hard and be diligent at whatever we were doing. So I ended up, my senior year, I had planned to figure skate, and I broke up with my figure skating partner, and so I was like, oh, well, why don't I go to college? And I fortunately had decent grades because of the diligencing. Anyway, so I applied to Hopkins simply because it was near my husband Ryan, boyfriend at the time, and we were walking around campus during a visit, and I said, what should I major in? I didn't even know what options there were for college majors. And he said, well, as long as you don't become an engineer, I'm sure you can graduate on time. And I said, fantastic, I'll become an engineer. So I walked around campus and just asked people what the hardest engineering major was. And they said, biomedical engineering. And I said, okay, that's what I'm going to be then. So it was a flaky, insane, almost as flaky and insane as how I picked my college is also how I picked my major. And then over time, though, I absolutely fell in love with it. And obviously enough so to come back and do a PhD. Right. But, you know, a lot of times people ask, well, are you using any of that now? And the truth is, absolutely. I think being a scientist, what you learn are kind of two important things. One is to search for truth above all else. So great scientists don't care to self-perpetuate their work. They just want to get to the bottom of something and understand the truth. And so they, you know, you pour into data and you really try to understand what's going on. And I feel like that's one thing that I've carried with me over to Thread, where our model has evolved. All kinds of things have changed over the last, you know, decade with our organization, but it's always in the pursuit of trying to understand what the real truth actually is. And then the second thing I really took from my experiences as a scientist is just, it's just the ability to problem solve and it's confidence. So, you know, when it comes to stuff with the kids, you know, we say this to the kids and their parents, we don't have any solutions. But what we can do is stay with you long enough to figure things out together. And I think science teaches you to think, and it teaches you to problem solve, and it teaches you to have the confidence, not that you have all the answers, but the confidence that you can find any answer or figure anything out. And that confidence has been really key when, you know, this work is really hard. Like, you know, if you have a kid who's missed 70 days of school, it's not like all of a sudden you just show up and say, you know, today everything's going to be different and we will go to, you know, it's not an overnight thing. It involves a lot of trial and error, a lot of long suffering. It's very difficult. So, you know, sometimes it's just the confidence that we'll figure it out and then conveying that confidence to everyone else in the organization that we will get there. We will figure this out. We just have to stay with it. And that's something I really took away from
science. It's a good grounded foundation to have when you're doing the work that you're doing with people, to have that ability to problem solve, but also be able to give problem solving to other people, to be able to share that, but still have a foundation of data. It sounded like it when you did your checklist in college and all that, you had definite ideas about that, but you weren't intractable. And so that really put in, you know, that really seems to be a good way of starting something. Speaking of starting something, how did Thread come about in 2004? Tell me, walk me through that.
So it just came about.
It wasn't called Thread then, right?
No, it's formerly the Incentive Mentoring Program. No, it literally came about from that moment driving into school and just noticing Dunbar next to the public housing and next to Hopkins. And so kind of what happened after that, once I had that, for me, epiphany that I felt more capable of basically forming an extended family for myself with high school students, because I'm rather introverted, I went over to the school and asked the principal if I could, you know, have 10 of his most underperforming high school freshmen, and he gave me 15, and 11 years later, we're here.
History, yeah.
The rest is history. Yeah, so when we started, though, I mean, I was the least likely person, I think, to do anything like this. I knew nothing about Baltimore City. I knew nothing about education. I knew nothing about running an organization. I didn't even know what a 501c3 was. But what I did know was that it was possible for the most underperforming students to succeed. That's what I knew. And I only had one data point, but one data point was all that I needed. And I think probably had I known more, it would have been a huge disadvantage, because all logic says freshman in high school, it's too late, or the most underperforming, it'll never work, or having 8 volunteers for one kid, that's impossible. You know, like, I think actually existing in a delusional bubble was a huge advantage in the early days, because I believed anything was possible, and those around me did too.
It says it's development, expansion, and replication of innovative paradigm shifting models. Give me examples of that, just in terms of what you do.
Well, I think what's the innovation is actually in the simplicity. So all that we do is facilitate relationships. That is really, in two words, what Thread is. It facilitates relationships. And importantly, it facilitates relationships across racial and socioeconomic boundaries that are sometimes difficult to permeate. So, you know, we start with the student, and then there's as many as 8 volunteers who surround that student. And at this point, we have 159 students, soon to be over 200. We have over 800 volunteers. It's really quite a large community that's diverse in every way. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to what we call the Thread family that surrounds the student, there are Thread resource teams. And those resource teams aren't meant to reinvent the wheel. So we would have like a legal resource team and health and SAT prep and tutoring. What those teams do is they connect our students and our volunteers to existing resources in the Baltimore community. So a lot of how we view the world is that in our minds, all the resources that we need are here. It's just a matter of connecting the dots. So, you know, a lot of the work that the resource teams do is connecting students to pro bono legal resources, right? It's connecting them to pro bono health services. There's a lot of service providers who want to provide this to kids in Baltimore City, but they don't know where to find them or how to connect with them or how to do it in a way that's comfortable, right? How do you transcend those barriers? And so really, you can think of it as concentric circles with the student in the center, the volunteers around the student, the resource team volunteers around, and then the broader Baltimore community. And really, it's the volunteers that are serving as the conduit between these very disconnected groups in Baltimore City.
What's your selection process like? How did you pick these 159?
So we first, we're currently at 2 high schools, soon to be 3. So we're at Dunbar, ACE, which is in Hamden, and Douglas will be our new high school site this fall. We receive from principals the academic information for the freshman class. So we're looking at the students in the freshman class who during the first quarter have the lowest GPA. So we look at the bottom 25% academically of the freshman class. And then we look at things like truancy. And then once we've kind of assessed which students are the most underperforming, we interview them to get a better idea of what's happening outside of school. So is the student living in poverty? Are they homeless? Is their parent deceased or incarcerated? Do they have a learning disability, mental illness? I mean, the list is very long. Sure. You know, the only thing that would disqualify a kid would be is if they had a very strong support system outside of school. So if in the interview we found out that they had a really strong support system and their academic performance was just likely a fluke, then that would be a disqualifier. But the more challenges outside of school, the better the match is for our family.
And this is all free for them. They don't have to pay anything?
That's a very interesting question. So they don't pay anything monetarily, but there is a cost. It's like with any relationship, you know, it's like a marriage. You can't just, there's nothing one-sided about a marriage that actually works. And so the cost is that in the initial phase, it's often us pursuing them. So they join and you tell them it's going to be 10 years. But it's hard for most 14-year-olds to conceptualize what a 10-year relationship looks like. And it's that first time that we show up at their house at 7 in the morning to drive them to school that they're like, oh, this is what this
is.
Reality seeps in, yeah. And I think what happens, though, is that a lot of times the first few months are them kind of avoiding us and us persisting and pursuing them. But then a very abrupt shift usually happens where kid says, why are you doing this? Why are you here? And it's very good conversation opener to then explain that. And what happens as the volunteers and the kids really get to know one another, the cost to the kid is not just time sitting there like doing their math homework, it's time pouring into the volunteer's life. So what happens is it becomes a very deep thing. So in my case, I remember back when I was still in graduate school and a volunteer because the first 6 years we were an all-volunteer organization. We didn't have any paid staff. And one of the students I'm closest with was sitting with me in lab at like Friday at 11 o'clock at night. And, you know, I had gotten in a habit where to do both graduate school and Thread, I was staying overnight in lab like four nights a week and like showering at the gym. And he said to me, he's like, why don't you go home? And I was like, well, I'm here working with you and I've got this MATLAB code to write, you know. And he's like, you're a horrible wife. And I was like, excuse me, this is like coming from a 17-year-old. I was like, he's like, you're terrible. I wouldn't want to be married to you. You know, like, you don't ever go home. Like, why don't you go spend time with your husband? And what's ironic about it is that, like, everyone else in my life was thinking that. My parents were thinking that. My siblings were thinking that. My husband was thinking that. My friends were thinking that. No one else had the balls to say it to me, right? And then he was just like, it was clear as day to him. He's like, why don't you go home? You know? And so that's the cost. The cost is that when you have a real relationship, you have to spend time getting to know the other person and you have to be a true family member to them. But no, I mean, there's no financial cost.
I like the way that you expanded upon like my question about cost, because I was actually just talking about financial, but that's very good. But it must be encouraging too that you, that a 17-year-old is comfortable enough to tell you that you're a bad wife.
You know, he was comfortable enough to tell me a lot of things about myself.
The thing is that you created a relationship with him, that he was able to do that and feel still, you know, secure to be able to do that.
Well, I think it's funny. I think when I think about the definition of love, love is actually, you know, not this mushy, you're so amazing thing. To me, true love is when you have a relationship with someone where they reflect back to you who you really are, both the good and the bad.
Right.
And I think that for all of us with the kids, and it's not just the relationships with the kids, it's the relationships with one another, right? You get to know the other volunteers, they become part of your extended family. And you know when love has happened. Love has happened when that kind of conversation can happen with a kid, because it's not just that he could say it, it's the way that he said it and the way that I could receive it. I could receive it not as criticism, but as someone who genuinely wanted what was best for me, just pointing something out so casually, you know, yeah.
Just to be able to feel comfortable.
Yeah. Honestly, that's part of our organizational culture. Part of how the model has evolved is not just kids being very blunt, but that type of relationship transcends how we function across the board. So volunteers, you know, over the years would say, we're not doing this well, this thing needs to be different, or we really are, you know, missing the mark here. There's just a very honest conversation about everything. And so what that's led to, you know, when we started, we didn't have the family model and we didn't have the resource teams and we didn't have all of these amazing collaborators who provide services. We just had my husband and I and 15 kids. And it's that model, that the paradigm shifting model has evolved from a culture of transparency and a culture of very direct conversations about what is and what needs to be, and then rapidly prototyping. So one of our core competencies is what we call failing successfully. It's not trying to get things perfect. It's let's try something. Let's honestly look at the data and did it work? Then let's revise based on what the data is telling us and try again. And doing that over and over and over and over again. And just getting comfortable with things not being perfect.
It's like what we were talking before we were on air.
Yeah.
It's a business plan. You always go toward it after a couple of months and see what works and what doesn't work.
Well, and I think of it, yeah, I mean, I know this is, that's a process of running a successful business, but I just think it's very uncomfortable for both the kids and the volunteers to get outside of their comfort zone. It is for everyone, right? Change is hard. So
sure.
Part of it is, you have to create a culture, and we've tried to create a culture where change is comfortable, where it's the status quo. Like the status quo is the rapid prototyping, less because it's our business model, but more because it's the best way we know to support people in growth. And when, in our case, people are growing, that is the whole organization.
Yeah,
so,
successful.
That's the key. See, if you're only asking the kids to grow, I don't think that works. It only works if you're modeling it not just in the individual relationships with the kid, but the whole organization has to be a living, breathing organism
sure.
that
it's
evolves.
It's got to be mutually beneficial. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've been at it for 10 years. We're recording this on August the 19th, so another school year starting soon. When you start up with the school year, is that right?
Oh, we go year-round. Right. So
I mean, in terms of getting new...
We enroll new students usually in December or January.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is there anything new or any other, for lack of a better word, policies or anything that you're implementing that's new in this school year?
Probably the most exciting thing that's happening this school year is the fact that we're expanding to a third site. So a lot of time has been spent over the last few years figuring out how to scale our model. And we've basically implemented a middle management infrastructure that's all volunteer-led, meaning the Thread family of 8 volunteers is actually led, managed, coordinated by another volunteer called a head of family. And there's many layers of volunteer leaders in different areas of the organization. They also lead the resource teams. And so that kind of implementation of the middle management infrastructure is maybe one of the most innovative things, I think, that's mm-hmm. happened. And we're in version 4.0 of that now, and that's enabling us to keep growing. So since development of that program, we've gone from 31 kids to 159, and that'll soon be 207. So it's, I think, for all of us that have been here for a while, you go through the process of seeing all the kids that, you know, we didn't have the capacity to enroll. Mm-hmm. And you just have this deep desire to want to enroll every student who qualifies and would like to be enrolled. So anyway, I think going to Douglas is a really big step for us. We've demonstrated at the second site that we can replicate the model at mm-hmm. a second high school and maintain really exemplary outcomes. And so now we're really excited to go and do that at a third site.
Well, how do you see Thread in about 3 to 5 years? Are you going to just expound on what you've been doing? Is there anything that you want to do that's different or that you have to wait upon? Or is it learn by doing and then keep the good things? What you've been doing, expand more anywhere, anytime you want to come in.
Yeah. So I guess maybe I'll start at 50 years and work back. So
okay.
I like to think of our mission is very specific, right? Our mission is really around building this extended family and creating access to resources to support our students into maturing into self-motivated, resilient, responsible adults. But in 50 years, like, what would it look like if we had accomplished our vision? Our vision is really, like, how would the world look different? The world would look different in that you would have this deeply connected community that's permanent, that's founded in personal relationships. But that community would really, in my mind, look more like what was originally envisioned in the civil rights movement, where it would be a truly diverse, racially, socioeconomically, all of the above, community of deeply connected people. And so, you know, what is it that I think needs to happen in the next 3 to 5 years to ensure that we can realize that vision long term? Mm-hmm. It really is around our student alumni. So, you know, it's not enough. To date, we've retained 100% of the kids. So every student that's ever been enrolled has remained for their 10 years in our program.
Yeah, wonderful.
Of the students that are of age to have graduated, 100% have finished high school. 96% have been accepted to college. And then our very first cohort of students that are now 10 years out, 60% have a four-year degree and 20% have completed a certification program. So the kids in that first cohort are actually older now than I was when we started. So they're like 25 years old, 26 years old. And what I've come to realize, again, it just goes to the long laundry list of things I'm ignorant about, but learning over time, is just education is just not enough. A kid can get a college degree, but if they can't find their first job and they move back home, all of those things that were home in high school are still home with a four-year college degree. Mm-hmm. And most people don't find their first job on the internet, right? So how do they? They find it from someone they know, but you have to know someone who has the capacity to offer you a job. So really a huge focus is thinking of Thread as a transition strategy in trying to put ourselves, like, we don't want to need to exist 50 years from now, mm-hmm. but in order to do so, we need to ensure that our students, when they are alumni and they have finished their education, are really given the opportunity to become leaders in the community. So leaders of businesses, leaders of boards, leaders of nonprofit organizations, whatever it is that they're passionate about, like how do we connect them with a career, not just an education, and a career that doesn't just allow them to be self-sustaining, but allows them to find like what their purpose is in life and what they feel really excited about and connected to. So we've created an alumni association this year where our first cohort of students are working with a group of volunteers and staff to really connect with local industry in terms of employment. And what we found that's important about that also is that a lot of our volunteers are actually scientists. And when they finish their undergraduate degrees or graduate degrees, they often leave Baltimore. And so just again, in kind of gaining a better understanding of Baltimore, if there's just an employment mismatch, right? There's a lot of service workers, not enough service jobs, and a lot of biotech jobs and not enough tech workers. And but that's somewhere we can really play a role in that our volunteers often can fill some of those tech jobs. They just aren't aware of them. So this awareness gap is not only something that exists in terms of, for example, providing pro bono legal services to our kids, but it's in terms of retaining the middle class to Baltimore City. A lot of times our volunteers don't know about these opportunities. So the Alumni Association is connecting both volunteers and kids to employment in the city in hopes of, you know, I think we've radically reconfigured the social support structure for our kids and our volunteers, but we'd like to radically and permanently reconfigure the social support structure. And that requires getting people to lay down roots. So in the next 3 to 5 years, what would I think things would look like? I'd like to see, you know, a huge volunteer alumni network living and working in the city. I'd like to see a large number of our student alumni living and working in the city so that we start to build really that core of permanent relationships, not just deep and meaningful ones.
It sounds like a terrific program. It sounds like you've done a lot of good work in 10 years and that you will do it in the next 10, 50 years, hopefully, that do it so well that you put yourself out of business. Yeah, that would be
I hope
a terrific paradigm.
Sooner than that, hopefully.
Yeah.
A 10-year plan would be optimal.
How are you funded?
So we are currently funded by foundations, individuals, and corporations, as well as Johns Hopkins University. We have been so lucky over the year. I mean, kind of our approach to this is that if you build a strong community, then the community will support itself. And we have been so lucky on the funding end. It's not just the foundations, individuals, corporations that have contributed financially, but in most cases, they are also involved in the organization in some other capacity, whether it's working directly with kids or
too,
it's what happens is sometimes within kind of our community, people bounce around. So they could start as a donor and then become a family member and then join a resource team over the course of a few years, or vice versa. You could have someone join as a family member and then end up being a collaborator that provides services and then become a donor. So we've been extraordinarily lucky. Part of that has also been, though, just as we've evolved, having those donors as thought partners. So the ABLE Foundation has been extremely instrumental in not just the financial aspect of things, but really helping us to, along the way, rapidly prototype our infrastructure and really understanding issues of scale while maintaining, you know, the root of just focused on the relationships with the kids. So we've been very lucky to have
such
deep and meaningful relationships,
multifaceted, you know,
partners, in every part of the organization, including our donors.
So that leads me to giving out your contact information.
Yeah, we would love anyone who might be interested in joining as a volunteer or collaborator or just learning more about our organization. You can visit thread.org or reach out to us at info@thread.org.
Well, this has been fascinating. Thank you for joining me here on Baltimore Internet Radio. This is just an introductory, and I hope that you come back. I hope you enjoy doing this.
I would love to, and maybe next time I could have one of our student alumni come and tell you about the work they're doing now in the in the city. So that'd be fantastic. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you very much for being here. I've been talking to Sarah Heminger, the co-founder of Thread. It provides a development, expansion, and replication of innovative paradigm-shifting models of mentoring. Thanks for being here, Sarah. I'm Dave Custy, and you've been listening to the Local Issues Forum.